She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome, friends and comrades, brothers and sisters. I'm Doug Miller here with Gren Schulman, and this is Amandla Radio, a weekly show with news and analysis from about on the continent of Africa. We try to dispel negative myths and stereotypes you get from the mainstream media and bring you the background, in-depth insights you won't get from that same mainstream media. So that here we are at CQT 90.3 FM. This week, I'm following up on an obit that occurred in June for an obituary for the death of J.B. Joshua, an evangelical preacher in Nigeria. And recent events in Malawi, where another evangelical preacher, Shepherd Bashiri, has been facing charges of from South Africa of charges of theft, fraud, and money laundering. And I just got me into the whole idea of evangelical churches and what was going on. And so there was a long article in The Guardian, and I'm following up on that this week. So that's me in the second part of the program. Gwen, what have you got to on the agenda today?
Yes, well, this week marks the 34th anniversary of the hour loss of Thomas Sankara to the assassin's bullet. And guess what? 34 years later, 14 men who stand accused of that crime are standing trial in Burkina Faso. So perhaps at long last, the impunity around the assassination of this revolutionary leader will come to some form of just conclusion. So I interviewed Aziz Fall of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation in Africa. Stay tuned. We'll come back. We'll come right back with that interview.
Yeah, man. Une chanson pour le capitaine Thomas Isidore Jean-Noël Sankara. Tu vas dans une gana, on te parle de quoi me grouma. Pourquoi chez moi, il n'en m'efface. On ne parle pas de Sankara. Pourquoi chez moi, il n'en me country. On ne parle pas de Sankara. Et pourtant, il fait partie du patrimoine de ce pays. Et pourtant, il fait partie. Bâtisseur de Mama Africa, ah, 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 eh. Si tu vas in Ethiopia, on te parle de cela, c'est Aïcha. Si tu vas au Mali, on te parle de Mungu Keita. Si tu vas down in South Africa, on te parle de Biko et Mandela. Pourquoi chez moi, il n'en me faso. On ne parle pas du capitaine. Pourquoi chez moi, il n'en me faso. On ne parle pas de Sankara. Et pourtant, il fait partie des diffuses Maman Africa. Et pourtant, il fait partie. Freedom fighters pour la cause de Mama Africa. Mm.
Sankara. La patrie ou la mort, nous vaincrons. Thomas Sankara. La patrie ou la mort, nous vaincrons. Thomas Sankara.
Welcome back to Amanla here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CQT.ca around the world. And as always, for the best of Amanla, please check out our blog at amandla.ca. So as I was saying in the introduction, it's the 34th anniversary of the assassination of Thomas Sankara, an event that certainly deeply shook Burkina Faso, all of Africa, and really the world over, especially for anti-imperialists and pan-Africanists. It was a profound, profound loss. 34 years later, finally, the case has been taken to court inside Burkina Faso. In fact, it's been taken to court several times, but here it is again in court, in a military court in Burkina Faso. 14 men stand accused of complicity in his murder. And I had the opportunity earlier today to talk to Aziz Fall of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. Aziz, who's a common guest here on Amandla and a former regular contributor, has been a driving force for more than two decades in ensuring that we all see this day, in ensuring that there be some form of justice and that those accused of participating in Thomas Sankara's assassination be brought to justice. And that's exactly what we're seeing in a courtroom now in Burkina Faso. It comes with a lot of challenges. The outcome is not clear. Aziz very eloquently brings us into the loop about what all of that is. But before I have you listen to the interview, I just want to fill in a couple of things that maybe weren't quite covered in the interview, but will help broaden out the story. So Thomas Sankara came to power, as I said, came to power over three decades ago, and was in power for 4 years before he was assassinated. But in that time, what he was able to demonstrate was the possibility for profound change and revolution in Africa. How did he do that? He did that through land redistribution. He did that through taking on huge financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, refusing structural adjustment programs, or what were called SAPs, which essentially were designed to continue to sap wealth from Africa through terms of trade and various other provisions that would absolutely ensure that a neo-colonial system of funneling resources out of Africa would be perpetuated. Thomas Sankara also took a very serious and hard look at unequal gender relations and addressed them in innovative and interesting ways within Burkina Bay society. Anyway, he was clearly a profound threat to the established order, and his rule ended 4 years later, assassinated. The person who very clearly was complicit in this went on to become the president of Burkina Faso for over two decades, ruled with a very brutal fist. That's Blaise Compaoré. In 2014, I believe, he was swept out of power in a popular revolt in Burkina Faso and has subsequently been hiding to great effect in neighboring Côte d'Ivoire, where he has married an Ivorian, gotten Ivorian citizenship, and is being tried in absentia. He refuses to come and face his accusers. And so that's what's going on there. So I just wanted to kind of fill in a little bit of the two key players. There are a number of others who were brought up in the interview, but I think that's enough for us to be able to kick off the interview. So here it is. Aziz Fall, welcome back to Amandla.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's been a while. So listen, it's been 34 years since the assassination of Thomas Sankara, and finally, at long last, 14 men are accused of complicity in his murder are on trial. So Aziz, you and I have known each other for a long time, and I know that you personally, along with a lot of others, have put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into seeing these men tried. So I really want to start with a personal question, which is, how do you feel? The trial has started in Burkina Faso.
Well, once again, this is, we should remind people, this is not the first trial. We have been doing this for the past 25 years. Mm-hmm. So we had several trials. The only difference is that we are no longer suing the state. It's now the state who is suing the indicted. So this is the major change. Otherwise, we are kind of relieved that, as you said, 14 defendants will be tried. There's a sense of bitterness as the judge has stopped the inquiry with the foreign involvement. That's the third declassified document arrived too late.
From France? These are the declassified documents from France?
From France, which entails that some of the witnesses that we would like to have would hardly be able to attend, but we are still trying to make them attend, which means that we may have another trial ahead as there is an instructor judge that is still doing the investigation. So far,
if I understand correctly, the declassified documents from France are not admissible at this particular trial. Is that it?
That's correct. But if the name of some of the people as witness belong to the previous two documents or are in the instruction itself, we can actually make sure that these people will be called as witness. During the investigations, anyway, an extradition warrant was issued against Yassine Kafando and against President Blaise Compaoré. Both were exiled to Côte d'Ivoire by France and have received citizenry.
And apparently immunity from having to say they're standing in absentia. Is that correct?
Yeah, but there is no immunity yet. They are clearly indicted, and there is an investigation still going on. Okay. He's just refusing to appear at the trial, saying that this is a political trial, forgetting that when Thomas was killed, he was the justice minister, never did anything for the next 9 years, and really politicized the whole thing. This is how we have wasted 20 years in his courts that he actually instrumentalized.
Okay, well, we're going to get back to Compaoré in a minute. So far, you're saying that there are nevertheless some severe limitations on this trial. That said, what do you think can come out of this trial? What would you like to see come out of it?
Well, one of the limitations I have not mentioned is that the military tribunal refused to allow the entire trial to be recorded. And for us, for the sake of history and archives of the military tribunal, but just for also the civil society, it's very important that the military prosecutor allow the trial. I mean, in terms of outcome...
Before you move to that, though, about the military trial, does that mean it's closed to the public or to the media, or will it be covered?
No, it's open. It's actually held... In a strange, it's kind of surrealistic. It's a banquet hall of Waga 2000. It's like a huge room, you know, for, you know, reception and big events. That's where they relocalized the trial. So public is allowed. You know, people are just searching scrutiny to make sure that they are not having any weapon, any cell phone, and so on. But so far, they don't want the people to record.
Record it. And why is it a military tribunal?
Because Sankara was a military, and most of the people killed were military, so that's according to the law, the jurisdiction that is in charge.
Okay. All right, so then let's get back to the question of, given these, you know, significant limitations, what do you think can be achieved by this trial? What would you like to see come out of it?
Well, truly, you know, the international campaign continues to advocate that due process and justice be served impartially and independently of any political pressure. There is a lot of political maneuvers going on because, you know, on the margin of the trial, the country is subjected to recurrent attacks by jihadist cells. These very cells were instrumentalized by the former regime. These people are saying that if they come back, they would actually restore peace and and they invoke immunity and amnesty for some of them to evoke national reconciliation. So this creates a kind of spirit that may jeopardize the whole effort of seeking the truth. In our side, we want to keep solemnity and respect for the rule of law, and we want to have a fair trial in order to first have an idea of what really happened, what is the truth about this thing, and then justice. And when this is done, I guess we will go towards reconciliation, which is obviously something that the whole country needs. Yeah. But all the Pan-African today are hoping, like any of us, that the truth would be known. And, you know, the political significance of this thing is huge, because we have to remind your listeners that the Sankara revolutionary episode was the last revolutionary episode in Africa in terms of changing the balance of power, changing the landscape with a neo-colonial mm-hmm. framework and so on. And to remind people that he was actually against the tide. The whole area was going towards structural adjustment policies while he was resisting it and saying we will not pay the debt, and you know that we have to go with a self-reliant development. So they have stopped that, which was the last Pan-African, you know, upheaval. And mm-hmm. you can see the rest with what happened with Libya and so on. So this is why there is an immense importance in terms of reviving the spirit mm-hmm. if we win this case for the Pan-African people around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, I'm going to skip ahead then to a question I had down my list, because I think it's relevant now. You were recently spent some time in Senegal. Assuming that there's a positive outcome to this trial in the sense that it does open the way to truth and then reconciliation in Burkina Faso, what was your sense in the region? Are people, youth, I guess, in particular, aware of Sankara's legacy, excited about it, ready to pick it up and move it forward if there's a space created to be able to do that? Do people still talk about Sankara in any kind of meaningful way? Or is he sort of an icon, but there's no real mobilization around his politics?
Well, actually, this is the amazing part of this whole story, is the fact that Thomas Sankara, that was not necessarily known by all this youth, who actually didn't even witness the revolutionary path, are actually the best advocate. I mean, they're the one with their advocacy, their, you know, their presence. They are the one who actually overthrew the regime of Blaise Compaoré. They are the one who created, you know, the phenomenon of resistance. And I just came a few days ago from the Cantor Summit in Montpellier, where, you know, this France-Afrique attempt to revamp the Francophone policy in Africa. And you can see from the Cantor Summit that the spirit of Sankara was deeply alive. The people attended my conference. And you just have the sense that in the diaspora or in West Africa, at least, Sankara's image and as an iconic figure of resistance and Pan-Africanism is still alive. You know, people are wearing posters, you know, in, you know, t-shirts and so on. You can really see that the whole generation actually from 30s and below deeply use his image as, you know, an image of resistance. So yes, he's still alive. And I think his dream is still alive.
Do you think the campaign to get this case, to get his murderers to trial, has contributed to keeping his legacy alive?
Well, definitely. I think our sections have done, you know, in the past 34 years, you know, Grilla was born in the same year than the Sankarist revolution. So I guess we contributed in a way by keeping mobilization and so on. And in the country itself, as you see, the Sankarist party mushroomed after his death, and today you have at least six Sankarist party, obviously not necessarily united, but just give a sense that the Sankarism as a project, which was not something existing in his lifetime, exists today. And deeply, I'm sure that we have contributed a great deal on making sure that the spirit and the dream of this self-reliant development continues in people's mind and heart. And this was, I think, our modest contribution.
The context in which the trial is going on now, so there's the government of President Kaboré in power in Burkina Faso right now. To what extent is that government reliable in protecting and ensuring that this is a trial that proceeds fairly, transparently, that it will not be undermined by forces that have every interest in it not having a clear and fair outcome?
Well, I think this is the most fragile part, as this government is in the driving seat, but not very well seated, in a way that he's weakened by, as I said, this recurrent attack by jihadists. You have at least 1 million people who have been displaced before because of the conflict. There's a lot of insecurity. Some of the people from the former regime are still involved in the actual regime. There is a kind of blackmail coming from Ivory Coast and France. So the country is really witnessing a strange, surrealistic situation where the people who are in charge have linked with the former regime, but in the same time are the ones suing them. So there is a lot of people saying that, well, this trial will be just a cosmetic one. Some others say that the indicted will certainly be judged and accused, but later they will have amnesty and so on for the sake of reconciliation. And as the regime of Roch Kabore is ending, there is already electoral pressure coming from all over the places. The Sankarists themselves are trying to reunite. I think they have a congress at the end of the month. Some of the factions are uniting with former party of Zida, who was one of the plotters after the second upheaval, you know, the one that chased Compaoré. So there is a strange climax going on, which just, I guess, is depriving us from the solemnity and the quietness of the respect of the rule of law. Mm-hmm. But in the same token, I must say that the population want to know what is happening. So we have, you know, a great deal of support coming from the population who wants to know what really happened.
Mm-hmm. You referred to blackmail by Côte d'Ivoire and France. Can you expand on that?
Well, you know that Blaise Compaoré sided with the Force Nouvelle for the overthrowing of Laurent Gbagbo. So they managed
in Côte d'Ivoire,
they managed to organize a civil war, which actually managed to get rid of Gbagbo. Gbagbo was sent to the Hague Court for nothing. He spent 10 years there, was finally released without charge, came back and started a new party. So there is obviously a strange situation where Alassane Ouattara is keeping Blaise Compaoré in his country. You know, Compaoré is married to an Ivorian lady, and that is the pretext of having this Ivory Coast citizenry. But in the same situation, as you know, there's a lot of workers working in the cocoa and coffee plantation in Ivory Coast. And they are used in a way, you know, also to destabilize
Burkina Bay migrant workers.
Yes. In Côte d'Ivoire. So, you know, this gave kind of a leverage, you know, to destabilize the country. And as I said, Djendéré and Compaoré was part of the AFRICOM plan in the sub-region, who actually have used some of this jihadist force to destabilize the area. So they know them. A few years ago, these guys were, you know, either seeking asylum in Ouagadougou or going back and forth in the hotel of Ouagadougou. So they were clearly linked to the destabilization of the regime during Sarkozy's presidency. So because of all of that, you have this situation where now they're saying they can bring peace because they are the only one who actually can really talk to these jihadist cells. So the destabilization of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso is deeply linked to these cells today. So there's a lot of political maneuvers with the slow retreat of the French forces these people are gaining more momentum, and this why the country, the state in Burkina Faso is becoming a little weaker.
Okay, I guess a last question. Can the Burkinabe and others who are very invested in the outcome of this, the fair outcome of this trial, is there a media landscape that they can rely on that is going to report well on the trial, on the forces that are attempting to derail or destabilize the process? Do people have access to good information?
Well, there is I guess, a very dynamic press in Burkina, you know, covering the case. And just amazingly, the last weeks, you can see that there is an international interest. We never had such a international coverage. Mm-hmm. But in the same token, you have a lot of people, you know, already gambling on the issue of the trial and making any kind of supposition while the trial is not even started. So it's hard to say who is really delivering with accuracy. We see L'Observateur, Palga, Bendre, and some other news. We will have our own website anyway, reporting on what is going on. So any of the listeners who would like to have at least the view from our side would be able to go on the International Campaign Justice for Sankara website. And if I can use also this opportunity to say that we are looking forward for the support of all the Pan-African in Burkina Faso and around the world to help us in this. This is a huge amount of money that is needed, you know, to convey our lawyers coming from elsewhere than in Burkina Faso, just for the past 10 days, because they are kept there. You know, you have to think about where they live, their security, what they eat, and so on. So this is a lot of money that Guerrilla is supporting with very little means. So any, you know, stipend sent, it is really appreciated. And we have a campaign to raise funds on the International Campaign website. So any of your listeners who would like to help is greatly appreciated.
Can you repeat the website, and we'll also put it on our blog?
Yes, so it's the International Campaign Justice for Sankara website, ICJS dot, well, I know the acronym in French is CIJS.
Yes, CIJS.
Dot ICSG dot net.
Okay. All right. And as I said, we'll put that on our post. And I gather for people who are interested in more information, that's also where they can go to get more information on the case.
Yeah. I'll paste it in the chat while we talk.
Okay. All right, Aziz, thank you very much. It's not over yet, but definitely a significant, important step forward. Congratulations for all the hard work you've done in getting it there. And we'll keep following this with you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the support all over the years, and I'm sure we will win. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
Spirit up above, beautiful number, but Hassan Roland Kirk.
The obituary of the death of T.B. Joshua in June this year caught my eye and aroused my suspicions. Tamitope Balogun Joshua was the so-called prophet and messianic leader of the Synagogue Church of All Nations, known as SCOAN by its many believers and disciples. I must start this article, this editorial, by acknowledging that I am a rational humanist who follows the tenets of good empirical science to explain the world and uses that same methodology to understand and explain human behavior. Belief systems that promote the supernatural and superstition are sociological phenomena and are tools of individuals and systems meant to control and exploit, rather than liberate and develop humankind. From the late 1960s, when I first settled in Malawi, I was exposed to the evangelizing self-righteousness of the old guard churches. Roman Catholic, Anglican, Presbyterians, and from the U.S. came the Baptists and Methodists, and of course from South Africa, the Dutch Reformed Church. They were the ideological opium to sweeten the harsh sting of colonialism, and in the words of David Livingstone, brought Christianity, civilization, and commerce to the savage tribes of pagans and heathens, which included Muslims at the time. And not to leave Canada and Quebec out of the colonial project, Quebec missionaries ran many of the schools and hospitals in Malawi and other parts of Africa. As I got closer to the liberation struggle in southern Africa and the movements leading their people's battles against imperialism, colonialism, and racism, I came to understand a much more liberating force than religion. There was strength in people uniting to overcome the forces that oppressed them. The ideology underpinning their strength was understanding the basic problems, the root causes of oppression and underdevelopment. And those are imperialism, colonialism, racism, and the capitalist domination of the world economy. The freedom struggles fulfilled the prophecy of Fan Fanon in The Wretched of the Earth and Black Skins, White Masks. Colonized mentalities had to be changed, and buying into the capitalist system would never end the poverty and exploitation. We left Africa in 76, and I was unable to return to Malawi until 1996, 20 years. When I got back, I found the old churches were still there, but lagging far behind a new wave. There were Adventists, Evangelicals, Pentecostals, Redemptionists. I'll use the terms interchangeably, despite what their practitioners may prefer. They had names I'd never heard of before. Living Waters Church, Mountains of Fire and Miracles Ministry, the Synagogue Church of All Nation, and Enlightened Christian Gathering. Many were still under the direct influence of foreign churches in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere, like Korea. Many others were homegrown in Africa, with Nigeria taking the lead in spawning new cults. While the old churches struggled to fill their pews, these new churches were growing exponentially in size, wealth, and influence. I have never paid much attention to religions and their practices, so my antipathy to the new phenomenon remained at quite a lower level than it did to the old-style churches, which were such an integral part of the historical process of colonization. Malawi now has its own multimillionaire prophet who made it big with his church in South Africa. His name is Major One, Pastor Shepherd Bushiri, and he has an online biography that brags about his businesses, his mansions, his number of cars, even his personal jet. My little research found two websites that named and described uncritically the 10 biggest churches in Nigeria, and another with the 10 biggest in South Africa, including Bushiri's Enlightened Church Gathering. I reflected on my most recent few years in Malawi, where I entered the homes of rich and poor Malawians and found TV screens broadcasting Emmanuel TV and Rainbow TV, and families kneeling together in prayer along with T.B. Joshua and Bushiri. These people have mastered the digital and multimedia art to expand their religious empires. That's where the obit of the self-styled prophet T.B. Joshua made me dig for a deeper reflection. The conversation is one source, a service that I use frequently, and it calls on the expertise of academic researchers to analyze events of the day. Two authors did a quick overview on June 9th of T.B. Joshua's legacy, almost immediately after his death. Tinashe Chimbukidzai is a doctoral research fellow at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Religious and Ethnic Diversity, and Josiah Taru is a lecturer at the Great Zimbabwe University. They wrote, and I quote now, "The popular Nigerian charismatic preacher and televangelist who has died at the age of 57 left a conflicting legacy. The co-founder of the Synagogue Church of All Nations megachurch was hailed by his ardent followers as a true man of God and a philanthropist who fed the poor, gave electricity, educational scholarships, emergency relief, employed young people in his football club. He had over 5 million followers on social media, with over 15,000 people attending his services weekly. T.B. Jothwa significantly transformed African Pentecostalism into a transnational global movement with branches in Austria, Ghana, the U.K., South Africa, Gabon, and Greece." Taru and Chimbukidzai also went on to say, "He's also attracted a great deal of criticism. His critics dismissed him as a fake prophet and a proponent of the health and wealth gospel, which takes advantage of his followers trapped in poverty. They say T.B. Joshua wielded immense political influence in Africa. He enjoyed close relationships with elites across the continent. He provided spiritual guidance to many African heads of states, politicians, business executives, and celebrities. Politicians regularly flock to consult him on issues affecting their daily life. For example, the former Ghanaian president, John Evans Atta Mills, was a regular visitor at T.B. Joshua's church. Other prominent people who had close ties with him included the Liberian president, George Weah, the former Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, and Tanzania's late president, John Magufuli. T.B. Joshua also made a number of controversial prophecies and predictions. He once told his followers that COVID-19 would miraculously go away. On the negative side, very negative, he was banned from YouTube in 2021 after complaints about his videos showed him exorcising the demons of homosexuality. So after reading those authors, I found another one. I also learned a great deal from a long article in a September issue of The Guardian by Matthew McNaught. He explained a lot about the evangelical movement and the growth of this younger generation of churches. The article was entitled, "From Lagos to Winchester, How a Divisive Nigerian Pastor Built a Global Following." McNaught has been writing a book about the evangelical and redemptionist movement. His article is too long to describe in detail and covers a broad range of elements important to the functioning and growth of these churches, these movements. However, some of the main points that I took away are that these churches really started their growth spurt with the rise of the neoliberal structural adjustment ideology of the 1980s after the election of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. They promote teach and they preach a gospel of wealth and health. They are very entrepreneurial and do not encourage collective or cooperative reaction to the forces keeping people down. The individual is responsible for praying their way out of poor health and poverty, and a failure to change their life situation is a personal failure. At the same time, the church leaders rake in enormous fortunes and accumulate great personal wealth from the believers and disciples who become their followers. From McNaught's article, this is how he explains that neoliberalism favored the growth of these churches. I quote, "T.B. Joshua found his vocation as prophet in a time of crisis in Nigeria after the high oil prices in the early 70s prompted a decade of state spending and dramatic growth. Their subsequent fall left Nigeria on the edge of an economic precipice. In 1986, the military regime was forced by the International Monetary Fund to accept a structural adjustment plan to facilitate the repayment of debts. The currency was radically devalued. Many state services collapsed. Much of Nigeria's emergent middle class was plunged into poverty. There was a wave of violent crime, kidnappings, carjackings, home invasions. It was in this context that a boom in Nigerian Pentecostalism began. Some scholars argue that this rise in Pentecostal Christianity amounted to a kind of neo-imperialism. At a time when Western financial institutions were imposing brutal austerity measures, Western preachers came to Nigeria spreading a prosperity gospel that taught people they could pray their way out of poverty, and that struggle and the struggle that mattered was in the spiritual realm, not the political. Other scholars have paid more attention to the ways in which Nigerians have taken this form of doing church and made it serve their own needs. McNaught carries on. Nigerians often lament the ways in which their country's abundance of natural resources has failed to translate into lasting prosperity, how they export raw materials such as petroleum and palm oil, only to buy them back from abroad in expensive, refined form. Joshua's trickster genius lay in the way he took the raw materials of Western Christianity and transformed them into something to sell to back to the West. Some of his influences were overt. On the walls of the synagogue church, there were framed pictures of famous, predominantly American evangelists, a group dubbed God's Generals by the U.S. writer Robert Liardon. The lives of these evangelists exemplified the man or woman of God as entrepreneur. Driven, individualistic, and charismatic, contemptuous of the checks and balances of the law or denominational church. Far from refining Western Pentecostalism, Joshua distressed it like stonewashed denim, taking advantage of Western Christians' yearning for supposed authenticity and the blind spots of their exoticizing gaze. In turn, the white faces and the BBC voices of these disciples always featured prominently on Emmanuel TV, thus giving his ministry extra prestige among his Lagos followers and the attendees of his stadium tours across the global south. Joshua rarely attempted personal anecdote or biblical interpretation. He traded in aphorisms, the kind of memorizable nuggets of inspiration that could provide equal comfort to lorry drivers and international businessmen. But Joshua had not simply hit on a formula with broad appeal. He meant different things to different people. It's not hard to understand his appeal among the locals of Ikoton Egbe, whose families his ministry nourished in the most literal way. It's a little harder to account for the hold over McNaught's old church friends, who'd swapped lives of privilege in the leafy suburbs of Winchester for the privations of disciple life. I can confirm McNaught's point that it's very hard to find critical information about any of these churches. He writes frustration about how difficult it was to find credible information about his church online. He was, according to the search results, either a great man of God or the Antichrist. The critical articles were as hyperbolic as the puff pieces. It's also remarkable how they avoid and deflect criticism and guilt despite some egregious behavior. There are documented cases of sexual, physical, and psychological abuse of disciples. Scone had built a multi-story guest house for disciples to live on the church camps and worship their prophet. McNaught interviewed two former disciples who, and I quote, described their experiences in astonishing detail. They spoke of sleep deprivation, public shaming, and a community in which Joshua was considered infallible. They described witnessing Nigerian disciples being whipped and beaten by Joshua. Oof, the female partner of the two ex-disciples accused Joshua of sexually abusing her over a period of several years. They left the church, but McNaught explains that they, quote, were not the only people to have left Scone because of alleged sexual abuse by Joshua. Two other British female disciples had left with stories similar to Kate's. Bisola Johnson, who'd been a senior Nigerian disciple, had made public allegations against Joshua, claiming she was one of numerous female disciples Joshua had abused. Her testimony had prompted Scone to release a lengthy video called Beware of Blasphemers, which accused Bisola of being possessed by evil spirits and having a contemptible character. And still, new disciples flocked to the church. McNaught walks through one scandal, major scandal, in great detail, the Scone hospital collapses. I quote now, on Friday, 12 September 2014, at around midday, a six-story Scone guest house collapsed. About 300 visitors were staying in the building at the time. Many were having dinner in the ground floor canteen. TV footage shows the aftermath, a dense tangle of twisted metal, ripped mattresses and bed sheets, layers of collapsed concrete floors. Weeks later, a final death toll would be confirmed. 116 people were killed, 85 of whom were visitors from South Africa. Over the coming months, the church's PR machine pushed Joshua's explanation for the collapse. Newspapers printed unquestioning stories about infrasonic weapons and planes flying overhead. In brackets, one brave journalist, Nicholas Ibekwe, released audio that captured Joshua offering cash for friendly stories. Some reports drew on the judgments of supposed engineers whose papers had hastily appeared in obscure pay-to-publish journals. One such paper contained 170 references, the vast majority of which were links to Emmanuel TV clips on YouTube with titles like Face to Face with Lucifer and Human Possessed by Lizard Demon. In 2015, a coroner's inquest concluded that Schoen was guilty of causing death through criminal negligence. They found that the guest house was constructed poorly, using substandard building materials without planning permission or input from a structural engineer. Builders had recently added two extra floors to the guest house without making changes to the foundation. Joshua was summoned to give evidence at the inquest several times, but failed to appear. He kept his head down for a few months, letting disciples take services. Then he returned. A criminal case was brought against Schoen by the Lagos government, but the case got nowhere, mired in endless adjournments and delays. Schoen resumed its status as the number one tourist destination in Nigeria, even while rubble from the guesthouse still lay in the Schoen complex. When I first heard Joshua's response to the collapse of the guesthouse, now this is McNaught talking, it seemed at the height of hubris and callousness. But it also made kind of a sense. One side effect of his claim of divine anointing was that it forced him to constantly outrun the facts of his ordinary humanity. To have even acknowledged the collapse as a tragedy would have risked a greater collapse in his reputation as man of God. He could only up the ante, whatever the cost to truth or dignity. The collapse could either be proof of his human fallibility or a satanic attack that proved his anointing. The Malawian pastor, Shepherd Bashiri, is demonstrating the same kind of impermeability at deflecting the criticism. After spending years in South Africa building his following and his fortune, he recently was charged with theft, fraud, and money laundering. At his court bail hearing appearance, thousands of disciples and followers filled the streets in front of the courthouse, proclaiming his innocence and demanding his release. Once on bail, he immediately skipped bail and managed to escape from South Africa. One story has him flying out of South Africa with a Malawian president who has been on a state visit to discuss official business with South African's president, Cyril Ramaphosa. In Malawi, he once again went to court because South Africa had filed an extradition request. This time, his Malawian disciples filled the streets and demanded his release. Signs read, "We demand his release. We will never allow him to be sent away." Later, Bashiri, in an address streamed by his television station, Rainbow TV, on the following Saturday, claimed there had been attempts on his life. His assets were seized ahead of his arrest, and his impounded Gulfstream III private jet is still parked at Lanseria Airport. The couple, Bashiri and his wife, also had to surrender their passports, but there was testimony during their bail hearing that they had several of these, among which were diplomatic passports granted to them by the Malawian government. The academics from the conversation, Tinashe Chimbikazai and Josiah Taru, also reviewed some of the prophecies of T.B. Joshua. Joshua's prophecy videos, purportedly demonstrating his foreknowledge of events in the news, have created headlines of their own. In 2012, he prophesied that an African head of state would die within 60 days. In a later video, he appeared to name a specific date. When the Malawi president, Bingu wa Mutharika, died of a cardiac arrest on that given day, he was succeeded by Joyce Banda, a devotee of T.B. Joshua, who'd visited his church several times. Chimbizikai and Josiah Taru continue. The prosperity gospel is most popular in contexts where people face significant economic and health challenges, such as Africa, Latin America, and among poor demographic populations in the West. Among such populations, faith becomes an important source of meaning and hope because people are vulnerable and face significant challenges or needs. People find great hope when their well-dressed, articulate, and affluent preacher tells them that all they need is faith in God for them to become wealthy and successful. These claims are often supported by testimonies from members of the congregation who testify how their sacrificial giving showed that they had more faith in God than in economic and social systems. Sadly, it is most often only the preacher whose wealth increases. These preachers also make enormous promises of healing. Chimbinskai and Haru carry on. Similar reasoning is used in relation to health and physical well-being. If you're sick or under threat of getting sick, you can overcome illness by faith. These preachers claim that the clearest way to demonstrate your faith is to choose the spiritual over the physical. In more extreme cases, preachers have told members to give their money to the church rather than pay for medicines or necessary treatments. These healings aren't cheap. Many wealthy and notable Africans have sought Joshua's healing miracles. These include the late Zimbabwean politician Morgan Tsvangirai, economic freedom fighters leader Julius Malema, and Malawian president Bingu Mwamutarika, and the late African National Congress leader Winnie Mandela. Chimbinskai and Taru conclude, Joshua held particularly unscientific and problematic views on disease in general, and COVID-19 in particular, claiming to heal persons from the disease. He prayed by the power of the Holy Ghost, by the power of the Holy Spirit, that affliction, that COVID-19, be flushed out. Those viruses in their internal organs be flushed out. And as they say, the authors say, the promise of healing or a solution to grinding economic woes is tempting, particularly when it seems that there are no reasonable alternatives. However, we must hold those religious leaders to account, especially those who use the desperation of the poor and invulnerable to enrich themselves and build personal empires. The prosperity gospel is a very recent phenomenon. From my own lifetime of research, I am convinced more than ever that Marx's dictum about religion is as true today as it was when he wrote in the mid-19th century. Karl Marx writes in Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right, and I quote Marx verbatim as in the translation, "Religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress and a protest against real distress. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of a spiritless situation. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is required for their real happiness. The demand to give up the illusion about its condition is the demand to give up the condition which needs illusions. In short, in my words, African evangelical or important evangelicism is not liberation and deflects people from solving the root causes of the problem that afflict them. My question is, why do so many intelligent socialist thinkers and leaders, why can they not convince people to act on their material conditions through class solidarity when the evangelicals can fill their churches and their coffers with promises of pie in the sky?
Welcome to Candid Africa, truthful and unapologetic.
Are there bookshops in Nigeria?
You know, I think it reflects very poorly on French people that you have to ask me that question. I really do. Because, I mean, I think in general that France doesn't seem to realize that it is no longer an 18th century world power. And I say this with sad honesty because I have affection for... the minister left. Oh, okay, good. I think that French, so I'm Anglophone African, I'm not Francophone, but I think that French, the history of French and Francophone relations, I find very vexed and troubling. I think it's interesting, this idea that the CFA, the Francophone currency, is somehow tied to the French franc. I find that really retrograde. I think that the way that there's a kind of cultural power that France wields over Francophone Africa that I think is unhealthy. I think Francophone films are really French films in a way that that's not the case in Anglophone West Africa. There is a kind of, I think the way that Anglophone Africans occupy their space in the UK is not the same way that Francophone Africans occupy their space in France. And, you know, and I think that Francophone Africans who know this, right? And maybe they should be the ones answering this question, because, you know, I read a bit about it, but I obviously I don't have a personal experience. But I should say that my criticism when I started out, and I stand by it, it's because I've had many unpleasant experiences with French immigration. Yesterday was different because they were actually polite, but every time I have come into France, and it's happened, I'm going to say 4 or 5 times in the past 2 years, there is a kind of contempt with which I am dealt with when I present my Nigerian passport that I really find indefensible. And I think it's important because the immigration officers are the first line of contact with the country, and so it shapes the way you think of a country. And I think it takes very little to be polite and to give people their basic dignity. And if I'm coming into a country and I have everything I need and I am legally there, then surely there's no reason to keep me for 30 minutes asking me ridiculous questions, ignoring me for long periods, and just being an ass. So that's what has shaped my irritation with... I think it's important to remember that all human beings really deserve equal dignity. It shouldn't depend on the passport that we carry.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amandla this week here at CQT 90.3. I want to invite you to help out our studio. The station has struggled through this last couple of years with the COVID, and so go to their website if there's anything you can do to support their efforts to keep community radio and programs like ours on the air. Gwen?
Well, yeah, right before we go, just to give you a little bit of a hint of what's coming up. Next week, we want to take a nice look at Abdulrazak Gurnah, who wonderfully won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Big fat surprise for everybody around the world, including him. Many of us, including myself, have not read him, had not heard of him. He's originally from Zanzibar, Tanzania, has lived most of his life in the United Kingdom. And a very interesting guy. I've had, since he won the prize, of course, we're all busy trying to find out who he is and what he's done and what he thinks. Sounds fantastic. So we really want to focus on him next week, pay tribute to him. He's only the 6th African to have ever won the Nobel Prize for Literature, which is, of course, a complete scandal. So good. We're glad. We're thrilled. It hasn't come without its own controversy, so we're also going to take a look at that. So please now stay tuned for Jazz Euphorium. Africa unite, Batsilele.
Africa unite, Batsilele.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
What's up, everyone? This is DJ Killajoule, Montreal born and raised, and I've been rocking the deck since 97. I've played with everyone from DJ Kubert to Mixmaster Mike, and I'll be the DJ once again for the second season of La Fin des Faibles on Télé-Québec. I'm here to announce the release of my upcoming EP, Sagittarius, which launches Friday, October 22nd at Ausgang Plaza. Doors open at 7 p.m. LTs will kick things off, followed by performances by End of the Week, Sunday Scratch Sessions, and the legendary B-Girl crew. Live visuals provided by Mourad Benacer. Space is limited, so get your tickets online now at pointdevente.com. The show is a CKUT co-presentation and sponsored by Prohibition.
So, other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's